Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole, how are you doing?
I'm melting.
Are you melting?
It's so hot.
Aww.
It's so hot.
Aww.
My glasses are slipping down my nose from sweat.
Aww.
Yeah, fuck off.
Pernell and Chris are here. How are you guys doing?
Oh, what a world. No, I'm doing fine. Just keeping busy, trying to keep busy, building a lot of stuff and cleaning a lot of things. No, surprisingly not melting. Air conditioning is doing its job, but I'm sure I'm paying the price in the wallet place. Lucky. Well,
I don't have central air conditioning, and my regular air conditioner has been reacting so badly to the heat wave that it freezes up every 10 minutes.
It can't keep up.
Yeah, it can't keep up.
Damn.
Yeah. Would it help if you end up doing the thing where you get like two and like run
them
in lower
temperatures? We have a second one in the girls' room, and the big one still cannot keep up.
Oof.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, and you're in Texas. How are things down there?
Well, we have central air everywhere, so like... Oof. It's relatively comfortable, but if I go outside, then yeah, it's apocalypse.
Apocalypse, wow.
Apocalypse, wow.
But basically, the weather sucks is what
this
we're getting
apocalypse
at.
Does not feel very wow to me. I was told there would be zombies. There's no way walking corpses would sustain themselves in this kind of heat.
Walking corpses couldn't sustain themselves in either end of the extremities. And I feel like the apocalypse wouldn't even amount to shit in this day and age. It'd be the saddest piece of crap ever. People would be killing themselves, killing each other over the last battery to play their Xbox. They wouldn't even amount to anything special. Like all the stuff that
need to learn how to use an inverter, like we did for 3 weeks.
That's the thing. In the apocalypse, they're coming for your inverter, but they're going to use it to play Xbox.
Yeah,
so I mean, that's what like I used mine for, to be fair, so I can't even say anything.
You're taking, guys.
I had two, one for the Xbox, one for the laptop and router.
That's all I picture now. Like, I'm still okay with, like, watching, you know, apocalypse media because, to be quite frank, it's, even if you take the most quote-unquote realistic apocalyptic scenarios that can be played out on a movie, it would still not go out that way because, good Lord, large populations and so many stupid people. It would just...
You know, I always had, like, the assumption, though, that apocalyptic media was wrong because people would band together to help each other. And like the pandemic has taught me I was wrong.
So you actually thought that people would band together?
Yeah, but I'm so disgustingly optimistic. I can't help myself.
Well, like, if it makes you feel better, the optimist.
Like, think that, you know, people would be like, yeah, here, let me help you out. And then I saw people hoarding toilet paper and hand sanitizer, and I was like, oh my God, I've been wrong my whole life.
Yeah.
I would say you're 50% wrong and 50% right, because...
I feel like that's a fence-sitter position for now.
Well, it is, because there's a reason behind it. Because while I have no doubt that people would not, quote-unquote, band together unanimously to support each other because humans suck, I do think that cliques of humans would collectively band together for mutual benefit and survival, which in case means... Hope you got friends, because you'll want to integrate with a community that will work together with you. But as far as the greater good, that shit doesn't roll. Okay, you'll get people to donate blood because they're afraid of needles, despite the fact that there's a genuine need. Like,
good point.
Like, I don't donate blood, so I can't say anything there. I hate needles.
I did, but now that I've been off chemo, I can't.
Hey, I'm not. Hey, just no, the important part is just acknowledging it. That's all there is to it. Like, I get letters now, and they're like, we're down to like 3 days supply of blood. We need people now. And now I got my friends who sit right there here, like, we'll be sitting next to me while I'm looking at the message, like, yeah, man, but needles scare me. I'm like, oh, yeah, people are fucking dying. But woo! It's
like, I don't even know what blood type I am. So,
really?
Yeah. Mine is taco grease.
That is something you should probably learn just for yourself.
I didn't know what mine was until I had babies. Because then they have to test, because I was having miscarriages, they had to test to see if like my blood and David's were incompatible. Because if mine was positive and his was negative, then it would cause miscarriages. And that wasn't it. We had other fucked up issues. But we're both type O, which means he's type O, I'm type O, and all three girls are all type O.
That should be a good thing. Yeah. Well, correction, because like it's universal, but that means you could all give blood to each other. So
yeah,
you're the type O's.
Yeah, it explains a lot about us, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Which means your blood type is in high demand then, because I'm type O, and they won't leave me the fuck alone.
You know though. Mosquitoes prefer type O blood, and they will travel miles for it.
Is that the truth? I used to joke about that, but I guess it's true, because I was like, that guy, I must have got that honey blood, because they won't leave me the fuck alone.
It is the legitimate truth. You are tastier to a skeeter.
I wonder if they can sense it, though. Like, they can tell what blood type you have, like, by smell or something. Like, whatever they have, that's considered a smell.
They can. It is true.
He that smells like taco grease.
That just sounds like Chris is somebody I want to hang out with. that knows where the fucking tacos are.
It's desirable to some, not to all.
Keeps the mosquitoes off of you by having them attack me. I'll take that's not even worth money to do that, because mosquitoes.
I'll take the malaria if you tell me where the tacos are.
I don't like tacos.
That doesn't sound like a good trade at all.
Oh, damn tacos. Screw that.
Brunel, you cannot say that you don't like tacos as a blanket statement if you haven't been to Texas.
No, just say you haven't had tacos
that you like yet.
No. I'm saying I don't like tacos that much to trade malaria for them. I love tacos. I do. It's fun.
Fat girl problems, but I do.
Tacos, you know what's funny? Delicious. I haven't had like any kind of like health problems or anything that have required me to know my own blood type, so I actually don't know it. So it's funny to me that I know the blood type of like people in Street Fighter 2 more than myself.
Well, I think what you need to remember is you need to have your bio flash across your eyes every 3 minutes or so while you're walking down the street. Of course, your birthday, which would become somehow outdated too, since, you know, Street Fighters don't age, but their birthday has a year on it.
Right.
So, like, I think what Chun-Li's like 60 right now.
Guile's 61. Well, no, he's 62. I mean, he's 60 as well, not 62.
It's just Simpsons. Street Fighter game will have their birthdays, but they'll shift the years over.
Why do you know their ages? I don't even know how old my mom is.
Look, some not information donate. Is what? Important.
Don't know your mom's birthday, Joseph.
No, I know her birthday. I don't know her birth year.
Oh. Chun-Li?
I guess I can't fault you for that, because parents don't want people to, mom, what's your birthday? You don't ask a woman her birth year. What?
Oh, yeah. You're not supposed to. There's two things you're never supposed to ask a lady. Her age and her pant size.
They hate me, so guess what? I'm asking everybody, how old are you?
Hey, if that's the case, is that why women have such, like, weird-ass, like, you know, pant sizes? Is
no, because that's because of misogyny and sexism.
Shoe sizes, too.
Like, that's a whole tangent.
Yeah, we're not going down that tangent. That's not happening on this episode. We're talking about tacos. We're talking about tacos. Fun tacos subjects. We're not going down.
That's not a non-fun subject. Because I'm going to wrap this episode. I'm going to look at it myself, because I thought that was a vanity thing, not a misogyny thing. No. I was like, they chose this.
People, no, we did not.
I don't think women chose anything about pants.
We don't
but
get
yeah.
to choose jack shit.
Oh my God, we're not going down this path. We are not going down this path. We're, we ain't got first game to talk about tonight is called Rims Racing.
Does Rims Racing have pockets for men and not for women?
Probably. Developed by Race Ward Studio, published by Nacon, released August 24th on Xbox One, Series X and S, PS4, PS5, PC and Switch for $49.99. A cross-generational edition, Ultimate Edition, is available for $79.99. That is right. The Xbox One and Series X, as well as PS4 and PS5, are separate purchases. Make sure you buy the right version. The first motorbike simulation that combines a realistic racing challenge with engineering and mechanics. Ride the world's most powerful motorbikes and optimize their performance by swapping out parts and analyzing data in real time. Purnell, this seems like it's a difficult one.
Because it is. Christ on a cracker. Yes, it is. So I'm not a sim guy. So devs hear that right there. I'm going to this is that dude's like Sims. So this is a sim. The idea behind this game is that you are an amateur racer who is joining a team and intent on becoming the champion of racing, maybe. So the method of which to go about doing that is by basically progressing up the ladder and eventually finding your spot on the boards. So what is that in regards to this game and simage? Well, starts out by creating your rider, you know, give him clothing, give him pretty much a, I don't think I got to choose a gender. So it was like, you make your rider.
Did you get to choose their pants?
You did actually get to choose their pants.
Their pants have pockets. That's your first clue.
Well, yeah, yeah. I don't think racers get pockets in this game. You know, racing.
If it's for men, it definitely has pockets.
But aerodynamic, you don't want pockets.
They're discreet.
But you basically build out your avatar and customize it with the intent to go. And it's kind of ridiculous how, I mean, I think racers are okay with it, but I always find it funny they let you do things like choosing choose your brake style and how many fingers are on the brake. I don't notice these things, but they let you go pretty nice and intricately with the customization. But once that's done, you're pretty much out into an office hub where car maintenance is done and where various things are done regarding like maintenance, so management and all. So what the hell is he talking about? Well, there is pretty much a garage, there's research, and there's your management team. And in all those cases, you have to pretty much spend some money to hire on those teams. It's almost like the entry fee to get started for the most part. For those things. But then once you pay the money, you unlock what would be a skill tree for each of those respective environments, management, research, and I guess maintenance pretty much. So what do those skill trees offer? Well, you pay money to open them up first, but then each of the nodes in the skill tree costs team points, which I'll explain shortly as far as like how you earn them. But team points are spent to unlock various elements such as, you know, things like, you know, shop discounts when you buy parts in actual bikes. It'll unlock things like more information as far as car parts and things of that nature go. So it's easier for you to make more well-informed decisions on customizing your bike and so on and so forth. And then there's the actual bike itself as far as like maintenance goes. There's a lot to this jump. Like, don't come into this game as some casual who just likes to get on a bike and ride, because you'll have a bad time. They go deep. I mean, you can do quick events, but I'm pretty sure that's not the meat and potatoes of this game. You're meant to do career and actually play the game.
Oh, yeah.
And they have you customized so much. You got I'm just reading off the different tier. Like, you pretty much can change like the brake pads. You can change your brake fluid. You have to maintain your fuel, like how much fuel you put out and take in. Cylinder, it's just, you're basically replacing a multitude of parts on the bike. As far as that goes, it's pretty deep. And I'm saying that as a compliment as far as like this type of game goes. Like, if you're down for the cause, this game has got you covered. And the thing is, like, as you play the game, the parts will wear out. And as the parts wear out, your bike's performance will eventually start to suffer for it, too. So you have to manage the bike parts and replace them as they come around. You get new bike parts either by buying them at the shop or by winning them in events. And when you go about the process of actually replacing the bike parts, there's actually like a mini game that you play to do it. Like, so for example, let's say you're removing the brake pads and replacing with new brake pads. They might have you say, okay, hold square and press left. Okay, now if that's done, rotate the stick counterclockwise. Now do this thing. Now the brake pads are off. And it's basically playing you through the entire, not the entire, because obviously you're not sitting with a bunch of parts on the floor, but it is walking you through a series of steps to kind of walk you through like a light version of like doing the job that you're doing for the bike tune-up. But once that's done, the thing is set up and ready to go. Now, after all that's done, well, it's not really after because you'll be doing that throughout the game. When you're comfortable, ready to race, you pretty much can go to a calendar. The calendar is pretty much what is determined, was pretty much like the order of events you'll be playing throughout the game. Scrolls from left to right, and each node on this event progress bar has pretty much an event for you to take place in. And each event has its own criteria for it. Sometimes it might be just a, might be just a typical race, it might be a heat, things of that nature. But then there's always, in addition to that, sub goals that might need to be met to earn extra money. Well, not always, but some events will do. We'll have extra money. Like it might be saying, like, you know, finish a lap or a section with a certain amount of time, or finish in a specific place. And those are things that you can do to earn basically bonus kudos. And when you finish the actual race proper, you'll earn money, which you can use to buy, you know, parts and the like, and team points, which is what I mentioned earlier, to unlock various trees in those, on those skill tree, or nodes on those skill trees. Each event can be done once. When it's done, you cannot go back to it. So I guess that is meant for you to revisit sometimes too, because you might do another season, and on a new season you'll try again, and hopefully you'll have better luck with like some of the better nodes, but or some of the goals that you might not have met before. But they treat it like an actual season in that when you, once a day is done, there's no going back to redo the event. You just say, yeah, take it as it is.
Yeah.
And of course, some events on here, like some days, you'll actually get to choose the event you want to do. Like, for example, it might be a heat or an event where it's a race, but it's sponsored by a bike company. So every person who's riding in the race has to ride on a specific type of bike. So it'll be like, hey, choose which one of these you want to be a part of. And then based on that, that's the race you'll, the event you'll do for that calendar node.
Carnage in chat wanted to point out, you can play replay events in a different mode in the game. It's just not during campaign.
Okay.
That makes lets you more retry sense, to get all the bonus objectives, but I guess, you know, to keep campaign moving,
you don't go back. Yeah. Well, that makes sense too. Like, cause it would suck if it was like never again, but if you can do it in another place, that's pretty cool. Just, you can't do it on the career mode itself. So the one thing about this game that I did notice that is fairly unique. Well, two things, because I'm not used to the second thing, though I'm sure it exists in other games. But the first thing is the big one. Oh, stop it, you. is the fact that while you're riding the bike, and I believe this is probably more for the gearheads, but it's still just cool in its own right. While you're riding the bike in the race, you can stop the game at any time by hitting the, whatever the hell that button's called, the touch button, the touchpad button. And it will actually zoom into your bike and give you an immediate, you know, detailed description of your bike's condition, like all the parts on the bike. You can see how well they're doing, if they're wearing and tearing or whatnot, and give you a general idea of like what the heck's going on. And while you're doing this, the game doesn't keep moving. So you are able to do this and take your time looking through what's going on with the bike without the game being like, come on, while you're looking at your bike, everyone's passing you, whatever. So it's kind of a nifty thing, and I've never seen another racing game do this, sim or otherwise. The other thing that I thought was interesting, though, I think this is fairly normal, is that this game, for better or worse, has some scenarios where you'll be taking some taking a lot of laps, which means the races can take a fair bit of time, which also means you could potentially run out of fuel or have issues with your bike parts during the race proper. At which point you'll need to pull into the pit stop, the pit lane, to get work done on your bike. Now, while this is happening, you're basically refueling your bike. You're doing some part swaps and whatnot as needed. And while this is happening, the race is still going. So at that point, I think the idea would be to say, check your bike stats while you're racing using that touchpad option. But then when you know what you need to do and you pull in that pit lane, get your ass moving, because you got many games to fill out. You got parts to select, and you got to get moving, because if you don't, you're going to drop into places while fixing your bike up. you can eventually do some things to remove the mini games themselves. But I feel like at least early on, it's kind of nifty. Be like, hey, it's not a simple thing. It's just like putting things on and taking them off. It actually would take work on an actual run of an actual race. So this is the best way we can come up with to simulate the work that goes into doing the work while you're racing the bike. Because again, this is a sim.
Yeah. I don't mind a sim, but what I want to know is the AI approachable, because we've run into games very similar to this where the AI is just unbeatable. Even on the easiest setting, the AI races flawlessly. They don't wreck. They push you down. And there was no way to do anything, and it ruined the game for me. And
I feel like the AI in this game, if you tune it down to the lowest tier, if need be, it's more manageable, because by the start of the game, that's exactly what I freaking did. I toned it right down.
Yeah.
And what that turned out, what that ended up meaning, is that my challenge wasn't in the other racers. It was just me sucking at driving the bike and not tipping over and crap and getting time penalties every time I just barely fell off the track. But in this case, it wasn't the racers that was the problem, and likely it was because they let you tune the AI down to a fairly manageable level. All in all, though, the game is nice. Like, it's not a bad game. I'm just mentioning the whole sim thing because I want it to be known that I'm not like a freaking savant, and I didn't like blow through this game. Man, it's the first thing.
I think you gave it a good description, though.
Yeah, it plays well, yeah. Like, and honestly, the bike is even, I can even manage the bike. I just suck at driving it because it's me. but the bike even manages well. And they do that thing just like in other Sims where they give you the optimal line to drive in, with green being go faster if you feel like it, or you're at least at a comfortable speed. You know, yellow being, hey, get a little too faster, champ. And red is like, you're going to fucking fall. But it serves. It's a good game. I think it works well for what it does. The track racing also, as a personal preference to me, is not silent. There's actually music while you're racing the bikes. It's not just, you know, vroom sound. It's actually music that plays, which is nice for me. It's a decent game. And I'd say it's worthy of a try, at least. Buy it if you are a fan of Sims and you want to try a little something new, because I do like the idea of the whole parts customization bit on that level.
Cool, sounds good. The only other question I have is, is this something worth getting the cross-generational bundle for, or are you good just picking a version and sticking with it?
I've always been this way, mind you, but I'd say just pick a version and stick with it. I mean, if you got to pay extra money to play the same game on two different systems, just get it once. I mean, you already own the machine, unless you have it at two different houses or something.
Arnage says two achievement lists, so...
Yeah. Oh, sweet, merciful, no. I only have so much time in my life. What is enough?
Oh, man. All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Tetris Effect Connected, developed by Monstars, Inc., Resonair, and Stage Games, published by Enhance, released August 18th on Steam for $39.99. Tetris Effect Connected adds an all-new robust multiplayer expansion to the huge variety of addictive and innovative single-player modes that Tetris Effect is known for, with all-new co-op and competitive online and local multiplayer modes. Chris... Tetris Effect, yeah. We all know, is an amazing game. How's the Steam version?
It's also amazing.
Cool.
All right.
$40. What's your verdict?
all right. Okay. So, yeah, Tetris Effect. Well, I mean, if people haven't heard the previous reviews or whatever, I can kind of summarize it. We all know what Tetris is, so I won't even bother explaining that. I mean, your mom knows what Tetris is. Ask her. This is Tetris with effects. I had actually never played this version of Tetris before, so it was actually really amusing to me that I was like, oh, it's Tetris, but with effects. That's why it's called Tetris Effect.
I'm surprised you never played this on PlayStation.
No, I don't play a lot on PlayStation unless I'm asked to, or if it's like, you know, something I'm looking for. I mean, I've been playing Tetris since the NES days, so it's kind of, you know, it's one of those where... when I'm playing it, I can easily dump hours and hours into it. But when I'm thinking about it outside of it, I'm just like, oh, yeah, it's Tetris. I've, you know, I played that before. I know what's going to go on here. So, yeah, this one follows like the kind of more modern Tetris rules, like pushing up on the controller causes instant drops. You know, it's not like the mean old NES version that people literally figured out, like, controller tapping in order to get better at, because that's still like the version people are playing. So this one has that. It has like the journey mode where it takes you through these like really, you know, new wavy kind of like levels and stuff with like these cool electronic songs and stuff. Songs have lyrics though, which is weird. I don't care for the lyrics in the songs while I'm playing Tetris. I'm like, I'm trying to zone out here. This is like somebody talking to me. anyways, so it's got all that. If you know, I don't think there's anything that's going to be surprising to people who have played this before, except that you can now control the Tetris game with a mouse by itself. And it's terrible. Don't do it. It's like you move the piece around left to right by moving the mouse left to right. One button flips, one button insta drops, and you'll never remember which one is which. And then the little spinny wheel in the middle, like, makes the level larger. And if you push down on it, it stores a piece, which storing a piece is a modern thing too. Okay. So I was asked mainly to like focus on the multiplayer of this game because it's connected. So that's why it's a big deal.
The meat and potatoes of Tetris Effect Connected is all the online play and all the online modes. So how did you enjoy those?
Oh, I like them. So we'll just break it down. There's four different things you can do, and so it shouldn't take too long. Of course you can play, it has like a overall, ranking system that, you know, you acquire points whenever you, win, a few points if you lose. So, you know, you're not totally lost if you're, they say you can lose points, but I'm too good at this game, so I haven't done it yet. So anyways, yeah, they have like different modes that you can play, and as you unlock ranks and tiers and stuff, like they drop in other avatars, kind of like weird little astrology looking things that you can play as, just kind of as a way to threaten predators and stuff. Anyway, so the actual game modes are connected, which is the most interesting one, and weirdly it harkens to, for me, back to the Tengen Tetris, which is the illegal, unlicensed Tetris that Tengen came out with back in the NES days. It used to have a two-player mode where you were two players, but the same field. So you were kind of like, you know, bumping into each other all the time, trying to clear this extra wide field with both control over both pieces, which, you know, we haven't really seen in a lot of home ports. So this one is, it takes that idea and raises it up even more. It matches three players together versus a computer player, and the computer player just has a conventional Tetris field in their side. Your three players also have conventional Tetris fields, but occasionally those three will combine, and then you're basically working for everybody. It's a group project at that point. So be ready to be let down.
That describes my experience playing online so well, because people are just, I've run into so many people who don't get that it's one at a time and we're fucking waiting for you to drop your goddamn piece.
My ghost piece is just sitting there waiting and you're trying to put your piece in there, and I'm like, come on, dude. Anyways. But the more lines you clear, the more it disrupts the AI, and then if you beat the AI, everybody gets points, and you're ranked based on how well you contributed, you know, unless I'm playing, and then you get either second or third place, because nobody contributes. I was getting like 49% versus everyone else's like 20%.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyways, so that's connected. It's brilliant. I really love it, and I can't wait to jump back into it with better people. So then there's Zone Battle, which is kind of a standard. Well, it describes itself as a standard one-on-one Tetris with a twist, the time-stopping zone mechanic. It's basically, yeah, Battle Tetris, where it, you know, as you get better drops and, you know, better combos and stuff, it raises the other side. I didn't mess around too much with it because I hate to say it, but I kept winning too quickly. Because, you know, I can drop like three Tetrises in a row, like within a first couple of minutes or so usually, and that's too much for a lot of people. But
we need to play Tetris against each other, and I believe this has cross play, so we
it does.
We need to figure this out.
And friend list playing. Anyways, so that's zone battle, and then you have two different score attack modes. You have modern score attack, which is just called score attack, and that's literally where it's just you are on your side, they're on their side, and you play Tetris, and whoever got more points wins. This is the only one I've lost so far, because just sometimes it just doesn't work out. But and also, like, I'm just not a huge score player. Like, I'm more into, like, the competitive, like, directly competitive versions.
Yeah, I can't do T-spins for the life of me.
Right, and yeah, T-spins, that's another modern thing, which is a good segue to classic score attack. Now, this one surprised me, too, because basically, you know, the modern Tetris, like, as of, I don't know, like, about 10 or 15 years ago, even more, actually, has always been about, like, T-spins, fast drops, and, you know, piece saving. Those three things, mostly. Well, if you take all of that away, make all the blocks extra sticky, you know, basically, then that's classic Tetris. And this one not only is classic Tetris in that it doesn't have the modern accoutrement, it actually looks like the NES Tetris, but, like, in 3D. So, like, the pieces actually, the colors reflect the original, the graphics look kind of 8-bit. It's doing a score attack with basically your mom's Tetris, which is what we wanted back in the late 80s anyway, but they never gave it to us because, you know, Tengen got, you know, butchered, and, you know, Nintendo was like, no two-player for you. You got to buy a second Game Boy and this Link cable to play it in black and white only. So yeah, at last we have our two-player NES Tetris, and it's right here in Tetris Effect Connected.
Cool. So sounds like you enjoyed this one.
Yeah, of course I did. It's Tetris.
Yeah, I mean,
but it really is good. I liked all four of these. Any one of them could have sold me this game, except Score Attack. I would have at least needed Zone Battle, but like the actual connected game, I think, is the star of the show here. But I also, on a personal level, appreciate the classic score attack. I do enjoy the ranking system, and, you know, I like that it just kind of gives you unlocks, you know. It's not like a shmup or something where you're, like, sitting there staring at the face of, like, the best player in the world all the time. the Darius game that I just reviewed recently does that. You can toggle it off, but it'll show you, like, who's number one and compare your score to theirs. And big surprise, it's not as good.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Well, anyway, overall, $40 on Tetris Effect Connected. What are you thinking?
Well, I don't have this on any other consoles, but I mean, just the fact that it also has cross-platform means that this, if you know, Steam is your thing, this is an easy buy it. If you have all the other versions, then I suppose it's just, I don't know exactly what they've added versus the others. I guess it's just the multiplayer aspect. Is it like just connected mode or
this is basically just a Steam release. Like
it's just all the
connected, all the effects and all the update stuff is hitting all platforms.
Okay.
Yeah.
So absolutely a buy it if Steam is your thing, because you can play with your console friends. And, you know, if this is your only version, then it's as a game, you know, in a vacuum, if this was the only release, then absolutely. I would say this is a great version of Tetris. A lot of fun.
Cool. And for the people who are interested, it is on sale until September 1st for $29.99.
Hey, there you go.
So big savings, $10 off.
All right.
Good shit. All right, next game is Fort Triumph, developed by Cookie Bite Entertainment, published by All In Games, released August 13th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $19.99. Every foe is deadly. Each encounter is unique. Fort Triumph is a challenging fantasy-based tactics game where permanent death is a possibility at any moment. How's that for pressure? Pernell, how is that for pressure?
It's a lot of pressure.
Cool. How's the game?
The game's asking something I consider to be a bit of a surprisingly interesting product. The idea behind Fort Triumph is it is a strategy RPG of sorts, or strategy tactics. It's a tactics RPG, where the idea being that there's a ridiculous story they slapped on top of it, which has honestly very funny dialogue. But the general idea is that these characters are trying to set off on their own to become heroes in their own right in a world where they got tired of just being built around for like crap pay and turdly contracts. So the way the game itself plays out, though, is that it has an overworld map of sorts where you will lead your party of heroes around it over the course of like a general, like an in-game calendar system, like it's broken down by weeks and days. When you stride out with your party and they walk across the map, you can go a certain number of steps per day. And as you explore the map, there are a variety of different events that might occur on said map, such as like finding items or monsters to fight, or again, general events where you might have to make a decision that might yield some cool loot or results. And oddly enough, while you are doing all this, there are rival units that are also doing the same thing. The game doesn't really explain who they are. They're just out there. It's another unit. So basically just got to mind your butt, because they're basically they're activating events and finding items as well. And when they find them, they take them. So that's things that you can't get. And eventually they will try to attack your base. So base, what the hell am I talking about? Well, I'll get to that in a few minutes. But the main meat and potatoes of the game is the actual combat itself, which can occur if you come across monsters on the map or an event that involves battle on the map. And the combat in this game really shines, in my opinion. The idea of it is that you can have up to 5 units in your party, and the units can consist of one of 4 classes, basically a paladin, a mage, a ranger, and a barbarian, or savage. Barbarian sounds better. And they all play very, very differently as far as their skills and abilities are concerned. The names kind of do enough justice to tell you what kind of characters they are. But what is cool about the combat is that each turn a character can move around. Like they have like their own movement range and things of that nature. And there is a decent cover system involved where if you walk up behind an object, they'll bring up a shield that indicates that you are being defended from that particular side or on that particular side. So it's kind of like you kind of wall yourself off. But it's not always foolproof, because this game has a surprisingly cool physics system in play. The physics system allows the characters to do things that can manipulate the environment in various ways. For example, mage characters can get a spell, some of them, not all of them, a hurricane spell where they can blow the hurricane towards like a tree or a rock, and it can push the tree over, or it can kick a rock out, and if it lands on an enemy, it does massive damage and stuns them. Rocks can slide into enemies and like whack them and then send them flying back, and if they hit another enemy, they'll do damage to them. A nice little ricochet effect. You can also just outright, some of the characters can just outright walk up and kick a guy. And like, hey, just move around the board and manipulate them. And honestly, I really came to appreciate that kind of thing. I like the idea of walking up, you know, hide behind a tree, blowing it over, and then like having my ranger use a grappling hook to grab the guy and then pull him into the rock that's next to him, and he does damage by slamming into the rock. There's a lot of cool mechanics like that in this game. Of course, there's cooldowns to the moves, though, so you can't just like spam tornadoes every turn, but I'd rather have cooldowns than an MP system, so I'll take it. The funny thing about this game, and that can go either way for folks, is the fact that, like I said earlier, you might have noticed I said up to 5 people in a party, but there's only 4 classes, right? You're like, what the hell? That doesn't make sense. Well, here's how it gets interesting. So you can have up to 3 parties total, and each of those parties can have up to 5 guys in it, which you can unlock by upgrading your base using beat coins and magic and renown. But eventually you can have up to that many people and that many party members. And the class system, there are more – every time you level up your character, you get SP. You use the SP to basically do one of 2 things. One, upgrade skills that you have learned, or spend them to unlock a new skill if you've leveled up high enough to have the open slot. But skills aren't linear. It's not like every mage learns explosion at level 5. Instead, what happens is when you go to learn a new ability, the game rolls 3 abilities for you. common abilities, uncommon abilities, rare abilities, and cross-class abilities. Sometimes you'll end up getting an ability option that is not typically learned by that class. And you might find yourself thinking, would it make sense for a mage to have a paladin like shield buff ability? Maybe. But I kind of like that aspect of things because that's how the game differentiates characters despite there only being four classes. There are more skills per class than you have slots to equip. You won't have the same skills on two mages or two barbarians. So you'll be working to do that. In addition to that, the game allows you to have like different skins for them, so they'll occasionally look different, whether they have like an overall different skin or if they just have a palette difference. So they'll bounce around a bit there. The only place where I feel like this system doesn't 100% shine is in the narrative, because what ends up happening is you have your character units. At the beginning of the game, they have identities and personalities. They're talking. They have names. But as you play the game, if characters die, they stay dead. They don't come back. So you'll have just like random units you're buying with beat coins or recruiting through a mission. And if you come to a story mission, they'll just kind of slide the dialogue to whatever character can fill the role of the person that would have said the dialogue. So it's still humorous and well-written and funny, but you don't really feel that connection to the characters because they're just basically – they're stumps. They're just stand-ins for the text. But don't let that be the thing that makes you go, this game is dumb, because – again, the game itself is genuinely fun to me. It's engaging. I will say one thing that's also worth noting, though, just to be safe. Well, two things. One, I didn't mention that you can upgrade your base with the resources you find to unlock, you know, permanent perks for your parties as a whole, increase your party troop size, which is how you eventually get to five people in a party. You can build, you know, facilities there that will do things such as like give you permanent health upgrades or like starting battles with extra AP points, which is, you know, how you do actions. And such and so forth. But the negative aspect that I wanted to mention is that even with the tutorial that the game gives you at the beginning, it takes a little getting used to early on, especially with the permadeath. When you come in with these characters who don't have any particular skills aside from their base set, and you don't roll a good, you know, difficulty random encounter on the map, or you just play poorly, you're going to fuck up. And it's going to be brutal. And you're going to be saves. No, well, say, I guess I call it saves coming, though they randomize the maps. But you will be resetting a few times until you get that entry period just right so you can start making decent progress. But once the progress is coming out, it's a lot of fun to play. I think it's a good game.
Cool. So $20, what is your verdict?
I think it's a genuine buy.
Cool. Works for me.
It will when you boot it up and your Xbox is functional. Get it going.
Yay. All right. Next game to talk about is Dreamscaper, developed by Afterburner, published by Freedom Games, released August 5th on the Switch for $24.99. By night, delve into your subconscious and discover powerful artifacts to conquer your nightmares. By day, explore Redhaven and build relationships to unlock dream powers. Dream, die, wake, repeat. Chris, tell us about Dreamscaper.
Okay. Well,
I was like, I hope you like it. I bought that one, but I haven't gotten a chance to start it.
Oh, okay. Well, let's find out. I don't know.
Ooh.
Ooh, I don't know. I'm trying to be mysterious, I guess. Okay, so yeah, Dreamscaper is basically a kind of a fresh take on the roguelite, which, you know, thanks to games like Hades and Moonlighter and stuff, is becoming like very much the in thing. So this one is the kind of take that it does is that you play as, I wrote it down, Cassidy. I'm so bad at names. But and Cassidy is a lady of mysterious origins. You could tell that she's like, you know, tortured by some internal darkness or something like that. But like in an interesting move, the game, like, even though it looks kind of nice and detailed and everybody kind of looks pretty interesting, nobody has a face. It's just like the blank from Dick Tracy. It's just like everybody's just got like nothing there.
Now it's like what was that game called? Ashen?
Yeah, something like that. There was a game I played recently that was like that too. Oh, the I can't remember the title of it, but it was where they only made eyebrows for the people, which is kind of funny. This one doesn't even have that. Anyway, so what happens is that it is a roguelite, so it's framed in that you have a hub world and, you know, where you improve your abilities and your loadout essentially, and then you go into the dungeon and then, you know, get as far as you can. And when you die, you come back with whatever the game lets you keep and then, you know, improve yourself and then go in stronger. And, you know, that's the whole process of a roguelite.
Dream,
so,
die, wake, repeat. Yeah.
Right. So interesting thing is that the whole outer world where you have just kind of a normal life is the hub world. So, Cassidy can like walk around this town and different parts of town become unlocked through gameplay, and she can meet people and like the way that she like gains levels. So you gather points when you're in the actual action sequence, and those, you know, when you die, you get those points, and then you can expend those points to get like stat increases and things like that for your loadout. But the way that they do it in the real world / hub world is that, like, if you want to gain, like, let's say some HP, you go to the park and sit on a bench and choose to meditate. And then, like, the meditations will, whichever particular one. And it's like self-affirming type messages and stuff. It's like, think about how strong you are or something like that. And then that actually increases your stats. So it's like, it's literally all in the mind. Because then when you're done in the hub world, talking to people, doing whatever, you know, just doing nothing special, you go back to bed and then have a nightmare, and that's the actual game. And, in the nightmare, you're kind of dour, Cassidy is now a badass warrior who can like do, melee attacks. There's a melee attack, which the weapon is randomized. I typically got boxing gloves, but you can get things like swords and daggers and a yo-yo at some point. And you also can like get, you also have a ranged weapon, which, you know, it could be a bow, or apparently it can even be finger guns. I haven't gotten that one yet, but it it looks fun. But anyways, and the by the way, the ranged weapons and special attacks and like kind of magical attacks as well, all use up, oh, what's it called? I forgot the actual name of the stuff. Well, it's lucid. It's lucidity or lucid points or something like that. And those are dropped by enemies. So like there's basically kind of an ammo system in here as well. And then yeah, as enemies drop, they give you more points and they give you more things and kind of unlock different things that will be available to you randomly throughout your future adventures. And of course there's big room sized bosses that you can run into, sometimes within just a couple of screens. So, you know, beware. And the bosses are kind of themed after typical kind of cognitive dissonance, you know, rage and, you know, depression and things like that. And, you know, they might take the form of like a big old whale or, you know, some giant monster, different things like that. So it's, I like it a lot. I actually really think that the having a mundane real world, even though there is like stuff going on, there is a real story to Cassidy that gets unraveled slowly as you, you know, keep going back into the dungeon and unlocking new areas and people. You know, there's nothing like really all that, you know, there's nothing magical like really happening in the real world. It's just when you go to sleep. And then that kind of takes a little bit of the, because you never really die. You just wake up. Like you always wake up right before like some visceral death, right? So yeah, I'm quite enamored with this thing, even though, you know, its bones and muscles are definitely just that of a roguelite, and we've seen that. But like I said, it's a pretty cool take on the formula. So
cool. Something we should mention is we know the composer. So
oh, do we? Who is it?
Dale North.
Oh, I love Dale North. I did not know that he did this one. Well, it has great music, so I'm happy that that he worked on it.
Yeah. So we just got to mention that up.
I was joking. I was like Dale North,
but I know Dale South.
Dale West, for sure.
Yeah, I guess we got to disclose stuff like that. Like, I've known Dale for 20 years. So
I haven't, but I follow him on Twitter, and he's a nice guy. He's a very pro composer, so, I mean.
He's good peoples, so.
Yeah.
Better than being con composer. I mean, that would be problematic. So better than being con composer, that would be rather problematic.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good thing he's not a damn fraud.
So anyway, Dreamscaper, $25. What do you say?
I say that $25 is the asking price for this kind of game, and so there, I have no reason to say not to buy it. It is a good buy it, I think. Cool. Yeah.
All right, next game is Creator Crate, developed by Jory Ryan, published by Creator Crate Games, released August 11th on Steam for $12.99. A fast, chaotic, and totally unique platformer with roguelike elements, outsmart everything that wants you dead with your grabby robot arm, rampage through a massive circular space station, grab, stab, block, throw, and devour your enemies, more than run and shoot, improvise, and create. Cole, tell us about your time with Creator Crate.
You basically covered the long and short of the game in the summary. Unfortunately, my time with it was a little marred by the fact that the game definitely wants you to play mouse and keyboard.
Yeah, which is something we brought up in the interview with Jory. So if you want to hear more about the game, go check out episode 705, maybe?
Don't check out episode shit. That wasn't a good episode.
I'm going to have to make an episode shit.
You can't throw off the counting, though, and we're not doing an extra episode because Bitches ain't got no time for that. But as far as Creator Crate goes, you're a little robot, you're trying to escape, you have this huge circular world that is a space station that's floating out in the middle of absolute fucking nowhere, and you're trying to get off of it, and I didn't do it. I tried. It's huge. But because the game is so reliant on the mouse and keyboard controls, playing it with a controller is a little more iffy, and it's not always as responsive or reactive as I would like for it to be. I certainly struggled with it from an accessibility standpoint. Now, as Joe has said, we talked to the dev about this. We did the whole interview. You should go listen to it. It's very insightful and wonderful, especially if you're interested in this game.
Carnage confirms it is 705. He checked.
What a good bean. So you should absolutely go and check that out. That is something that the dev is aware of. But because I am so reliant on using a controller that had a heavy cloud hanging over my entire time with Creator Crate, there were certainly instances where I wanted to get the momentum to move through large areas rather quickly, because you could see like a defined path that would let you do that. But because I was using the controller, I couldn't manipulate it in a way that would let me carry out the escape route that I could see.
No.
And that became frustrating, which is a shame, because otherwise I think it's a really interesting concept. I think it's a lot of fun, and I like the way that they've made it to how you can interact with the humans that are there, the objects that are there, and how you can, you know, manipulate the game to escape your own way. But because it's not controller friendly, I wasn't able to enjoy it in a way that I think other people who can play mouse and keyboard successfully could have.
Now, Pernell, you played this one as well. What did you think?
I mean, I honestly had a bit of a similar concern regarding the controls that Cole mentioned. But I will say that I was able to adapt to them a little bit more just by virtue of just doing, you know, patchwork stuff. Like I mentioned in the interview, where I kind of hold my hands in a different way when it came time to like combine motions such as the grapple coupled with the jump and swing. However, of course, that could get a little problematic if you're being chased or something like that. And it's like, well, no time for the thing now. It's got to move it. But with that said, though, I feel like there is... I could definitely see the reason why the mouse and keyboard facet was a thing that they were concerned about, because even if they were to, even if Jory were to have said, let you use your left hand to control, use a controller and your right hand to use a mouse, I feel like there'd still be some like weird disconnects there. And the mouse is a strong element for like the usage of the keyboard mouse bit. I like the slapstick aspect of it all. I like the idea of the resource management that comes into play with actually, you know, what you can turn into matter versus what you need to use of your matter to produce things. And then determining also if you need to not produce things in favor of healing yourself instead. It's a fun product. A particular run could run a fair bit of time, though, if you're a dawdler. It's worth noting because, though, like Cole said, those levels are pretty huge. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm the same way. I'm honestly the same way. You heard me talk about how I had to find every hidden nook and cranny, which is also why in the interview I made sure to say, are there secrets? Because if there are secrets, I will never finish anything. But when she gave that nice answer, I was like, okay, good. And kind of just rush more. But you still sometimes find yourself wanting to spot, you know, things that can turn into matter, that you can turn into matter when you're like kind of low on this stuff, which means you'll still be kind of looking around for things. So, but all in all, I think the game is creative and enjoyable.
Well, the game is $13. What do the two of you think?
I'm in buy it town. Try it more so if you're concerned about the whole mouse keyboard bit. But if you don't care, it's a buy.
All your thoughts?
I think it's definitely worth its $13 price tag. But I do see knocking it down to a try it if you're in the accessibility department like I am.
Or if you're just not a fan of mouse and keyboard, because I don't have any accessibility issues. I'm not good with mouse and keyboard.
Yeah,
like me trying to move with WASD and jump it was laughable. I could not do it. My brain doesn't do games that way. And
I can manage the controls. I can't. It's just that it causes fatigue and I can't hold my hand in that position for very long.
And in my case, like I'm sort of like how Joe was describing, but after playing games, like I mentioned in the interview, also like that Noitude Glove 2, which is also originally, before it became on the Wii, that was a mouse keyboard game. And that was a game that made me realize, you know, I don't like mouse and keyboard, but if the game designed well enough with it, I'll adapt just for that game. But if you don't have to do it, please don't do it.
Give us controller support.
I have done the thing where I hold the controller in my left and the mouse with my right. I have done that in a few games in the past. And it's better than trying to navigate with just the keyboard, but it's still eventually fatigue just kicks in for the hand that's on the mouse.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing more games approach a mouse and controller option.
It is a good way to play if you can handle it. I will even go so far as to say there have been some games that I have played with varying degrees of success, but I have sometimes used my input monitor, my drawing monitor, as I did it in some practice matches in Call of Duty. I would use my controller. But then with the updates, though, when Cold War came out, they made it to where you can't do that. It locks it. But I used to do it.
I didn't know you couldn't.
Yeah, you can't anymore. It does it on Xbox, too. If you have a controller connected, it locks out keyboards. Unless you go in and swap over to the keyboard, and then it locks out. You can't swap to your controller. But you used to be able to, and I did it for a while, just fucking around, using the controller for movement and using my touchpin.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's really good for targeting, and I've actually seen some professional players who play shooters and use a stylus and digitizer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Next game to talk about is called Rise Eterna, developed by Makey TA Publishing and Forever Entertainment, published by Forever Entertainment, released August 20th on Xbox One for $19.99. Feed your nostalgia with a tactical RPG inspired by the greatest classical titles. Take on an adventurous journey, meet a whole range of unique characters, and immerse yourself in an engaging storyline. Pernell, tell us about your time with Rise Eterna.
So Rise Eterna is a game where I guess the best thing to compare it to would be like Fire Emblem as far as how gameplay itself flows. You are Lua, a girl whose village was ransacked and trashed by bandits. And as this has occurred, she was told that if she were ever in need to go on an adventure to go meet a man in a town. and to accompany her is one of the bandits that raided the town, or rather, he was a member of the unit that he didn't raid the town with him, who joins up with her on her journey for reasons. So your progression is a sequence where you go from map to map on the world map screen, and then when you actually encounter a battle, you go into a top-down grid-based brawl. Characters have movement points or movement stats and attack and defense and whatnot. And on your turn, you move all of your units into position to do damage via combat. If an enemy is within a decent enough distance between themselves and an opponent, you can initiate an attack, which will lead to a side-scrolling battle where the character will animate and do damage. And if the opponent happens to have a counter ability, they will counter. Otherwise, that will be it. Had to mention that because in something like Fire Emblem, damn near everybody's got counters. So that's not the case in this game, though. So not always the thing. Generally on a map, your conditions generally will usually revolve around something akin to kill all enemies or reach X exit point or kill units and reach exit point. So the actual goals don't get particularly complicated or overly varied, but it's just enough to kind of motivate you through the stages. This game has no experience point system whatsoever. Instead, what it does is at the end of every battle, every character gets a skill point, which can be spent on the character's respective skill trees. And every character has two different skill trees. They're not complicated skill trees, mind you, but nonetheless, there are two of them. One is the generic skills tree. It's the tree that everyone has. All the skills are exactly the same across all the characters, and it will be things like heal for X amount of damage when your health is below 50%, or, you know, increase amulet slots, which is the thing you equip to, you know, augment stats and stuff in this game, because there's no weapon equips, just amulet pools.
Can I just appreciate that the skills are literally called hero skills and generic skills?
Hey, they let you know. They ain't nothing special about these. Everyone can do it. Even the village knave. Even he can increase his hit points by two. Nothing special about that guy. They basically break it down the way where, like, the hero skills are going to be the thing that makes your character different from another character. And the skill trees themselves, it only ever branches out into a string of, like two nodes. And what I mean by that is it goes one node, then to two nodes, and then depending on no matter which one you've gone to, after you've finished it, they both converge back to a single node, and then two nodes back to one node, whatever. So it never gets too complicated as far as plotting a path through goes. However, it is worth noting that in order to move to the next node, you have to max out the current node. So, for example, making up a skill here. Increase hit points by two. It might say have four slots on it. You have to upgrade that four times before moving on to the next option of skills for that trip. So I hope you like the skills you're going for, because you're spending four battles worth of skill points to upgrade it in order to move away from it. So there you go. Now there here comes two things that, well, I guess it's technically the same thing, but that is okay, but I also am not the biggest fan of it because of what I'm going to get into. So, there are no shops in this game, and there's no money in this game. So, how do you get things? Also worth noting, there's no healing magic in this game. So, how do you heal yourself, and how do you get stuff if there are no shops or healing magic? And the answer to that question is by finding things on the map. As you do a stage, the game will have a variety of treasure chests on it, and they'll have a variety of, collection points. And when you come across a collection point, if you have an item, you check it, and it'll give you various items like berries or phosphorus or soil. And if you have an item that corresponds to that type of collection point, you'll get, like, extra stuff. It's all... is everyone okay?
Hello? Yeah. Yeah.
Hello? I'm here. I was like, oh, everything's okay. It's like...
Chris is just making noise.
That's my chair. I'll just mute myself.
No!
The creaky chair, no.
And now, so basically you go to all these collection points or treasure chests, and you take the stuff there, and at the end of a map, you can go to the main menu to combine a combination of these things to get items like healing potions and paralysis bombs and the like. In addition to those things, you can also sometimes find amulets of varying quality, which you can equip to give yourself your character stat bumps. However, the problem with this is that the things you find are 100% randomized. There is no determined stuff that you will find. So healing potions are how you heal. And if you don't have a healing potion, you need to make one. And if you don't have the ingredients to make a healing potion, well, you got to go get them. And how do you get them? Redoing maps. And what happens if you redo a map and you didn't get the ingredients to make a healing potion? You got to do it again. So can you imagine? You can probably guess that that can become a bit of an annoyance if you get to the point where you need potions. It's not a total loss, of course, because you do get skill points when you do a map. But I don't want to redo maps like that. That's just how I am. But that part aside, the gameplay itself is fairly straightforward. Actually, I guess there's one more issue I have, which is that so you can't check your item inventory in the game per character unless you actually do the whole thing where you move a unit next to another unit and do like trade or use. But you can't, like, say, just hover over a unit and click them and see what their stats are and what their item load is. All you can see is their icon. You can see their base stats, mind you. But you can't see their items unless you do a trade or a use. So that gets kind of annoying sometimes. But aside from that, honestly, the gameplay itself is fairly straightforward. It's no frills, really. Like, it's not complicated. It doesn't break the bank. But it scratches the itch if you've played out all the other strategy RPGs and you want that one more hit. Because it is a fun title. It does the job.
And to be fair, the market for this game is, like, there's not a huge amount of these games on Xbox. So the market's wide open.
Oh, that's a good hit then. In that case, the only thing I can say then, in addition to the other things I've said, because, man, I got to come up with better terminology, is
it's unique.
Please patch in more actually, there we go. I'll use that. Please patch in more unique tunes because it's the same battle music over and over and over and over again. Put more music in here, please. Please. It's not a bad theme, but it doesn't particularly stand out either. It's a very basic beat, and it plays over every battle. Please add more. But otherwise, I think the game is all right, and I like the story a bit. I like the graphic style, too. So,
$20. What's your verdict?
Based on how you described it for the Xbox market, I say it's a buy it. Get yourself some strategy role playing game on here.
Cool. Sounds good.
It is.
All right. Next up is Drama, developed and published by Shared Dream Studios, released August 6th on Steam for $4.99. An exciting game full of traps and mysteries to be solved in each of its 96 levels. In this hostile story, you must put all your skills to the test to solve the hidden enigmas and lead Frank to the end of this compelling story in 2D. Chris, tell us about Drama.
In 2D.
Magical 2D.
Put on your special 2D glasses, folks. Anyway, Drama is the story of, I don't know. You go into a portal that appears in your backyard and you have to go through like 96 stages of whatnot. This is what I don't know if there is a name officially for this subgenre of precision platforming. I like to call it a silhouette platformer, because I think that pretty much tells you what you need to know about how it looks. In fact, we got two of them today. I don't know. I guess it was just because that one game, like, years and years ago, like, what's it called? Y'all know the one. Limbo. Thank you. I had the L and the I, and I was drawing the N in my brain, and then you said it. I guess that must be what it is that people really like those silhouette platformers. This one, the little twist that they uh, that they decided to put in here. Well, for one, it's a double-edged sword because it's, you know, that they basically have, like, each level has different things that you can do to, like, figure out how to get from one end of the stage to the other. Usually the stages are simply one screen. And you have to figure out how to get across, like, usually spike traps and whatnot. So the thing about it, though, is that in order to kind of, you know, surprise you, I suppose, they lock out the ability to play this game with a controller. You have to use a keyboard. And because sometimes you have to use a mouse.
Interesting.
So I'll give you an early example. Like, there's one stage, it's pretty easy to get across. You know, the hint is, you know, but the end of the stage is blocked off with a door. And the game's hint is that the doors, every stage has a hint that you can click on anytime. And it costs you a life to use. You start with 1,000 lives. And I guess it's kind of a de facto scoring system, is that if you beat the game, then, you know, try to do it with as many lives as you can left over. But yeah, it costs you a life to use a hint. But like, the hint for the stage was that the door is movable. Try moving it. And, you know, nothing you can do to that character with that character, like, will move that door. And, you know, you might try a whole bunch of things, and then eventually you'll figure out, oh, I'm just going to move my mouse over here and click and drag it away. And then that's what the solution is. So, you know, it does, like, cool things like that. There was one stage. So if you fall on the spikes, then you become dismembered, like most of these things tend to do. They tend to be very violent, these silhouette platformers. Anyway, like Dream Alone especially, like, that's one that I reviewed at some point. That's actually very much like the kind of vibes I got from this one. But anyways, so, you know, you of course eviscerate and fall apart, and, you know, your body parts are on the spikes and stuff, and then your next character comes out, but the body's still there. Sometimes you can actually use the dead body of your prior life as a platform, because it actually does have a hitbox. So I don't know how to explain that in, like, in real life physics terms, but, you know, that is actually a thing. And I appreciated that quite a lot. I mean, this is a budget title, clearly small, you know, a small indie dev. I really like that they implemented some ideas into a genre that can very easily be done stale.
No.
And I do mean stale.
Well, it's $5. What do you say?
If you're interested in, like, in a puzzle platformer that, like, has a difference, I mean, it definitely, it shows its cheapness, I will say. Like, frame rate's pretty low, and, you know, controls aren't great. But it's not really about all that. It's basically, you know, you go through it to figure out all the different, like, actual puzzles rather than, you know, precise platforming or anything like that. Because when it comes to precise platforming, honestly, you can just, like, dump a couple of bodies in there and jump across them. They do disappear, though, after a while. So you kind of have to plan on that, too, if that's your thing. But I'm going to go ahead and give it a try it based on just, you know, on its
uniqueness,
sort of cheapness. Yeah, I guess it's closer to a fuck it, why not? But if you are, like, interested in these, like, in these sort of meta puzzles, then sure, yeah, it's a buy it.
Cool. All right, final game to talk about tonight is called Badland Game of the Year Edition, developed by Frogmind, published by Cubic Games, released August 6th on the Switch for $5.99. Fly and survive through the Game of the Year winning Badland and discover an astonishing number of imaginative traps, puzzles, and obstacles in the way. Cole, tell us about your time with Badland.
This is basically like if Flappy Bird had a love child with Limbo, and to still Chris's term, it's a silhouette. It's not a platformer, technically, I don't guess, because it's that Flappy Bird type of gameplay.
Yeah.
But it has that silhouette aesthetic. I want to say that this game was originally made for mobile in 2013, so that was when every mobile game was Flappy Bird.
In fact, this exact version, the Game of the Year edition, or whatever they call it, is on the Wii U as well.
Yeah. So this is an older game that's just getting re-released on a new platform.
And I will say, major props that they're only doing it at $6, because we see so many remasters coming out at $20, $30, $40. To see one come out at $6, and it's, I don't know how long it's on sale, but it's on sale for $4 right now.
When I bought it, it was on sale for $3.99, and after reward points, I paid $1.22.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an inexpensive game, and it's fine. It really is. I don't like these kind of Flappy Bird type of games because the repetitive motion is bad for my joints. And so when I saw this originally, I looked at it and I thought, oh, it's kind of platformery, maybe a little bit of like a runner or something. I didn't watch a video. I just looked at the screenshots. So my expectations for it were clearly way off. That's my own fault. But the screen does scroll to the side. You have a little bit of freedom about how you move around in the stages. The levels are kind of short and sweet, but they go from one straight into the next. There's not a whole lot of time to like relax and let your wrist recuperate if you have arthritis like I do. There are increasingly more difficult obstacles that you'll need to overcome as you progress through the levels. I want to kind of fuss a little bit because I feel like the game doesn't prepare you for throwing that at you. When you first start off, you're just kind of going left to right and nothing bothers you. You just kind of make it for better or for worse. However, somewhere around, I want to say it was level 9 or 10, suddenly things just start murdering you, and there's no expectation that that's going to happen because you've had all these other levels where you're like, no, I just made it. Oh, that's a spike. Doesn't hurt me. Oh, that's a that's a spinning set of blades. Doesn't mean a damn thing. Right. But then all of a sudden you're just like flapping along as you do in level 9 or 10 or whatever it was, and then boom, you hit a mine and you're fucked up, and there's nothing that prepares you for that. Especially as you start to move along in the game, you will collect other of these little creatures. They look like dust mites as far as I'm concerned.
They're in silhouette, so who cares, right?
Yeah, these little flappy handed creatures, and you'll pick up more of them. There's interesting effects where, like, you could pick up power-ups and some of them will make you small, some of them will make you big, some of them will make you go quicker. That's all well and good, but they're just kind of thrown around so haphazardly in the beginning that you don't really quite learn how to use them to solve puzzles until it's too late. So I don't like that the difficulty just ramps up out of nowhere because you're just sitting there going, nothing killed me before. Nobody told me I needed to get, you know, any specific one of these little silhouette creatures to the end. But it is what it is. You just kind of, you flap. There are obstacles. Try not to die. It's a $5 game. $6? I guess it's $6.
Yeah. $5.99.
It's a $6. So,
Chris, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm of the same mind. I mean, it didn't annoy me that, like, the game suddenly decides to start killing you. That seems like an artistic move, you know?
That's that this game was a mobile game kind of development right there.
Oh, really?
Now either it wants you to pay for lives or it wants you to wait 24 hours to get more lives.
I didn't catch that because I don't play mobile games. Yeah. So, okay.
That's how they get you.
Ooh, that's like super epic Entertainment Wars type stuff, which, by the way, has a Flappy Bird clone in it as well. Yeah. I completely missed the Flappy Bird phenomenon. It's one of those kind of games. It's like mobile games that I have played. It's like you don't think much of it, but as soon as it's in your hand, you can't put it back down, and you're just kind of freaked out. You're just like, wait, why am I still playing this? I don't even like it.
That is kind of what happened. I was sitting here with my feet up, and I was waiting on Windows to reinstall, and I'm just like, I just sat here this whole time installing Windows and playing this Flappy Bird type game, and I don't even know if I like it or not. I just sat here playing it anyway.
I think that I liked it.
Right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, there was nothing really wrong with it is the thing. So it's a curious thing for sure because it's so cheap, like it, and it looks really good. So that throws me off. usually when something costs less than $5, it looks like it. But then again, it, like Cole says, it's an old game, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was originally priced higher. I think it's still $12 on Xbox.
It is very pretty.
It is pretty for what it is. I mean, the backgrounds are really well done. The world is really nicely illustrated. It's just that it shows what it is and it shows its age.
Yeah.
All right. Well, overall, $6 verdicts.
Can I go with a fuck it, why not here?
Yeah.
I kind of feel like a fuck it, why not is suitable.
Is that
like
allowed?
It's just one of those time killer kind of games. It's inexpensive and you just put your feet up while you're waiting on something and flap your way through some hellscape and then call it a day.
And we should reiterate, that's a good rating.
That is a good rating.
Just below buy it. It means that it's cheap enough that fuck it, just buy it. It's worth your money.
Yeah,
I think some people do like to seek out these games to kind of get hooked on, and it's very hooky. So for that reason, I'm actually just going to go ahead and say buy it.
Cool.
It's if you want a cheap game that's actually quality, like, you know, those are few and far between on this console. So, you know, kind of worth it to check out the ones that are there to kind of give you that perspective.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that is it for this episode.
Yeah. Oh,
we made it through. Good job, everyone. We did it.
I think I melted into my chair.
You melted into your chair.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of it. I think I'm attached to it now.
Is it a leather chair? Are you just like adhesed onto it for good now?
Yeah.
This is how
I die.
Yeah, it is.
We'll see you next time, folks. Be a tribute to Cole.
Yeah, next episode, a tribute to Cole. Rip in peace.
To Cole.
I guess, Cole, do you have any final words?
Rest in pepperonis me.